Student Education, please come to order. Today is Monday, March 10th, 2014. The time is 8:02 a.m. In attendance are myself, Senator Gary Stevens, Vice Chair Senator Dunleavy, and Senator Stebbins. We have a quorum to do business. Today we're dealing with three bills, SJR 23, relating to a constitutional amendment allowing state debt for student loans, SB 195, revisions to the Alaska Student Loan Program and ACPE, and Senate Bill 100 relating to correspondence study and allotment. So let's start with SJR 23. Thank you for being with us. Senator, if you'd come forward, please. We're under dealing with version U. Senator Faircloth.
Mr. Chairman, SJR 23, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, Senator Anna Faircloth, East Anchorage, Eagle River, with me this morning at the table carrying this bill is Kristen Pratt from my staff. SJR 23 proposes to ask voters of the state of Alaska if we can refinance post-secondary loans. In a nutshell, that's it. We could use the, it would also allow us to use the good credit of the state of Alaska to be able to provide both those in the past and those in the future with a lower rate of interest on their student loans.
Thank you very much, Senator. Any questions? Anyone else you have asked to testify? Well, thank you much, Senator. We'll go ahead and go into public testimony then. So open the hearing to public testimony. Do you have any online? Anybody in the room? Okay, a closed public testimony. A discussion among the committee. Any thoughts you'd care to share?
Bill sponsor come back?
Yeah, if you'd come back, Senator Faircloth.
Mr. Chairman, maybe we can have the bill sponsor explain to us why we don't have, why we'd have to go to a constitutional amendment versus going through the standard process through appropriations to set the state in a position to do that with.
Well, thank you. And we have Senate President Huggins with us. Senator.
Thank you. Through the Chair, Senator Stedman, right now, currently, Alaska's Constitution only allows us to bond with the full faith and credit of the state of Alaska for housing, for housing loans for veterans and for capital improvement projects. This would depart from that particular constitutional authority.
But that's not the question. Why do we need to do that? Why don't we just use the ability we have in the Treasury to go in and restructure notes and also even look at other loan programs, forgiveness loan programs or whatever else, if we're going to try to help people deal with education costs? Why do we have to change the Constitution to accomplish the goal?
Through the Chairman, Senator Stedman, certainly is the will of the body if they want to go in with general fund dollars and reduce student loans. That hasn't been something that we've done in the past. Right now, if I might continue, Mr.
Yes,
Chairman.
Yes, please, Senator.
Right now, the loans are issued, and they're issued against the revenues that the students will pay. That's a little bit higher percentage in the bond market to pay, to issue those loans.
So there's, Mr. Chairman, so there's no other mechanism that the state has short of changing the Constitution to resolve the issue?
Mr. Chairman, the legislature could, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, through the chair, Senator Stedman, the legislature could fully fund the program and help students redo their loans if we wanted to. It would be a billion. We have quite a bit of loan outstanding, so there would be an issue of fairness out there. We have loans, I believe, out there since the 1980s that are still sitting out there that have been refinanced by students and other bonds that have been placed out there.
Yes, please, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To committee members, before this could actually ever happen, it would go to a vote of the people. In the 2014 2014 election. Then after that, another election, I'm sorry, then the commission would have to come back to the legislature and say, Mother, may I? And they would have to explain to the legislature that this was a benefit to the students and to the legislature to go forward and do. And then the voters, as early, the earliest point that they could say yes is 2016. The earliest student that could receive a dollar of what we're considering today is probably for a school year in 2017.
So the actual vote would take place in the general election in 2016.
The vote on SJR 23 would be in the general election in 2014 if the legislature, by a supermajority, allowed it to go on the ballot.
Thank you. Any further questions? What is the will of the committee? Senator?
I move SJR 23, version U, from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
I think there's any objection. I will take a brief at ease then. Senator Faircloth, thank you for staying there. We're going on to Senate Bill 195, Alaska Post-Secondary Education Financing, and we have version U in front of us. And if you'd present the bill, Senator Faircloth.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate Education Committee, my name is Senator Anna Faircloth. I represent East Anchorage and Eagle River. With me this morning at the table is Kristen Pratt. She's assisting me on Senate Bill 195. This bill makes both substantive and housekeeping changes to Alaska state statutes regarding the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education in the Alaska Student Fund, the Alaska Student Loan Corporation. These changes include allowing the commission to set favorable terms for borrowers, increase the total loan limit a student may borrow. Currently, loan limits have not been changed in almost 20 years. The costs of post-secondary education, though, have gone up or almost doubled since 1995. Alaska students and their finance aid officers report that borrowers with high unmet costs of attendance are increasingly choosing loans with higher loan limits, even those that have higher interest rates. This bill defines what an on-time student is so that they can reach and accomplish their goals and, in my opinion, have less student loan. This benefits the student by enabling them to enter the workforce sooner and by entering repayment sooner so that they have less debt to carry. There is strong evidence that shows a correlation between the intensity of the enrollment of a student and their completion rates. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you, Senator Faircloth. So now who does this affect? How does this affect the students as they progress towards getting their degrees? How many years can they use this? Can you just give us a little background on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committee members, if I could ask Diane Behrens to join me at the table, we can certainly look at the sectional. It increases, I'm trying to find in the bill where it expands the amount that a student can borrow. On page 13.
Would you like Ms. Behrens to come forward, if you would, please?
Yeah. on page 13, and it takes line 12 through 14, it takes the loan limit from $42,500 to $56,000 all the way, if you go through those up to line 14, from $60,000 to $87,000 for an undergraduate and graduate student. So because people are having to take a variety of loans, they're just having to go for higher rate loans. This bill allows consolidation of those loans, and when they're going to borrow, that they can meet at one-stop shop what they need in the degree that they're pursuing.
Thank you, Senator. I was just concerned about the amount of years that a student can take this loan. It has to be done in 4 years? I don't think so. Probably they've got longer than that, 5 years. How many years, and how long will it be available to a student? Just sort of get us an idea of that.
Certainly. Mr. Chair, my name is Diane Behrens. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education. There is actually not a limit on the number of years a student can access the loans. There's a total dollar amount, so there's an aggregate limit. So if they take smaller amounts over a longer period of time, then that would be their pattern of borrowing.
And do they have to be full-time students while they're receiving the loan, or can they be part-time?
Mr. Chair, they can be part-time students. They have to be enrolled at least part-time, and they have to be matriculated into a certificate or degree program.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. Further questions, Senator Gardner? I apologize. Senator Gardner came in some time ago. Senator Gardner?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I understand that currently, if students have multiple loans and they want to pay one off early, they are required to pay the oldest one, not the one with the highest interest rate. Is that correct? And what would, in regardless of your answer, what would be the impact on the loans that are being consolidated, if the loans are all consolidated?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, your understanding is not correct.
Oh, good.
A student, as long as their other loans are paid to a current status, they can prepay any loan they select, and of course, paying the highest interest rate loan first would be to their benefit.
Thank you. I'm glad.
And with respect to consolidation, when an individual chooses to consolidate, they consolidate at the prevailing rate. So right now that rate is 7.3% if they were to consolidate their loans with us. One of the things that currently is in place that this bill would change is that the only education loans they can consolidate with us are the loans that we have made. This bill would allow us to consolidate in their other education loans from other lenders.
Thank you.
As a parent who hopefully is done with this, paying student loans, does this also apply to loans that parents are paying to ACP?
Through the chair, it does. No, Mr. Chair, it does.
Thank you. Further questions? Senator Sid.
Yeah. Diane, can you explain to us the interest rate environment a little bit and why we're at 7.3 and not some other number, and why we don't have a forgiveness program like we had before, and other mechanisms to encourage people not only to go to school but come back to the state if and live here?
Certainly. Through the chair, Senator Stedman, with respect to the interest rate, the market environment post 2008 has substantially changed, and the rates that we're able to achieve in the market with asset-backed bonds have risen substantially. So the rate of funds at this time would be about probably 5% if we were accessing the market, which we're not. Currently, our loan volume has dropped to such an extent that we're able to use available cash to fund those loans. But the market has changed substantially, which the previous legislation that was before you would address that issue, allowing us to leverage the AAA rating of the state, even though the bonds would be paid down with revenues from the loans. With respect to forgiveness, that program was a very generous program, as you know, that the state funded through 1987. Then as a result of the fluctuation in revenue to the state from oil, That program was eliminated. The corporation has...
And what year was that?
1987.
Thank you.
That was the year that the corporation was established for the purpose of allowing student loans to become essentially an enterprise operation of the state, operating off of its own receipts. The only thing that would keep us from once again instituting a forgiveness program would be making capital available to, or funding available to, pay those costs.
Senator Price.
And for the borrower, a young Alaskan that decides to go off to school, are they going to be better off paying that 7.3 or 5.5, or are they going to be better off with a 50% forgiveness program?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, we've just posted an analysis of the old loan forgiveness program. What we found in looking at the almost $500 million of loans that the state funded from the general fund was that fewer than 30% of the students enjoyed any benefit from that forgiveness, and about 21% of those actually received the full 50% forgiveness. The cost to the loan program was actually larger in loan write-offs from individuals who failed to repay the debt than the cost of loan forgiveness itself. About $74 million in loans were forgiven for those of us, and I have to, in full disclosure, I was one of those who received forgiveness on my loans, but we were in the minority. So it would depend on which of those students you were as to whether or not it would be more beneficial to you to have a loan that has no forgiveness provision and one that does. I think that the mindset of borrowers back during that day, I don't know if you recall, was that it wasn't really a loan. They were taking out money that they did not really expect to have to pay back, and so their attitude toward that debt was perhaps more cavalier than an individual borrowing a loan that they understand they're fully obligated to repay.
If I can follow up on that, full disclosure, I also received that to get my PhD, and the nice thing about it, I mean, I realize we're not really talking about that now, but it's a very important issue, and I think legislators just really love the idea of forgiveness, mainly because I understand that sort of cavalier attitude at times, but just the idea that if people spend 5 years working in Alaska, they probably are going to stay in Alaska, and I think that happened with a lot of teachers. I know that's not a part of your how you calculate things, but I think legislators have always liked that idea of encouraging people to take out student loans and stay in Alaska. Senator Stedman?
I'm having trouble with some of the concepts here. I too had one of those loans, with forgiveness loans, but if you, somebody at the time in the 80s signed the note, and we fast forward today and signed the note, it's still the same obligation to pay back whoever you borrowed the funds from. It's a state or a bank or whoever. So I have a hard time drawing the conclusion that it was different attitudes at the time, and the folks back in the 80s felt they didn't have to pay it any more than the folks today that signed a note feel that they'd have to pay it. So I have a little trouble with that. The underwriting requirements and other issues as far as, you know, the amount that went into receivership, or, and I'm sure there's quite a few that are still out there that have been written off. I'm not so sure that couldn't be rectified somewhat in how the program's structured. So I think we have some tools available to us that if we don't have time this year, maybe we should talk about it in the future. I think having charging someone 5% a year or 7% a year is a whole lot different than allowing them a 50% forgiveness, which, as I recall back looking at the old amortization tables years ago, was about equivalent to paying back the money without it being inflation-proofed. And we could run those tables and do those calculations, but it was pretty much a return of capital to the state and then to lend out again. And as far as the policy call, what mechanisms we have to buy down interest rates and things like that, we have a lot of tools available to us when we have liquidity in the Treasury, which we do. There's no other state that I know of in the Union our size or even close to our size that have $18 billion in cash sitting there, $17 billion in cash. So those resources that the Treasury owns are owned by everybody collectively in the state, including the young children and the recent graduates. So I'm more inclined, Mr. Chairman, as we work through not only this bill but other pieces of legislation, to try to come up with some mechanism to encourage the students to come back to the state, much like the program the governor put forward to encourage them to go to in-state schools, trying to keep from having a brain drain here.
If I just say, Mr. Chair, Senator Stidman, that is a question of the legislative will, whether or not those programs could be put in place. What I've recommended in the past, if there's an interest in doing that, is developing loan repayment programs. Those are programs that, rather than as an entitlement under a loan contract, which may sound good today, but the state may not be in a position to make good on it in the future, to actually pre-fund an account that those monies can be used to pay down student loans for individuals who complete their credentials or working in an area that the state feels is of its economic interest, supporting its economic interest, and to pay down their loans. The state actually, the legislature actually created such a program 2 years ago that is focused on healthcare professions, but it is a case in point that the budget for that program, the second year it's been in the budget, has been cut in half. So the individuals who were recruited into certain healthcare jobs or their employers are seeking to retain them are now at risk of not receiving that benefit. And so what we're proposing here is something that is sustainable without relying on that year-to-year expectation of funding.
Thank you, Ms. Burns. Further questions, comments? Yes.
We could rob the governor's scholarship fund.
Is that a recommendation, sir?
Sorry. Clearly, we have some work to do on this. I think there's a lot of people in this room who are interested in trying to find some solution, and that idea of assisting those who could complete makes a lot of sense to me. Any further questions on the bill before us or comments? Senator Farrell, any further? We sort of interrupted your presentation. Any comments you have in addition that we have not covered?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I hope that you'll consider moving the bill out of committee. It has a long way to go. It is an effort that Ms. Behrens and I have been working on for over a year in trying to look at the load that students are carrying across our state, reflective of the student loan debt that's across our nation, and trying to provide another tool that the legislature can use at its discretion in the future to help assist students. Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Thank you, Senator Farrell. And Ms. Behrens, we sort of leaped right into asking you questions. Is there anything in general you want to say about the bill before us?
I would appreciate your support. First of all, I'd like to thank Senator Fairclough for her willingness to lead on this. To me, the key provisions in the bill are the ones that allow us to incent on-time enrollment. As she indicated, we're trying to make it possible for students to expedite their time to degree. What we find in Alaska is that a large proportion of our students do not attend full-time. They attend part-time, and if you look at them statistically, students who attend only part-time generally complete their credential in very low numbers. And so if we can turn that around, because at the same time those part-time students are incurring debt that they have to repay regardless of whether or not they complete their degree. So I would request your support.
Thank you, Ms. Burns. Senator Sedman.
Just forgot to ask this one question, and I might have not heard it correctly or misinterpreted what was being said. Previously, a couple decades ago, when we had the loan forgiveness program. We had some structure that managed that entity. And then today we have another structure. Is there a size escalation in the number of folks that it takes to administer today's programs versus the old one out of the 80s? Or is it all the same? Or is another way of asking it, is there something underlying all these issues that have the ability to increase, stay the same, or decrease the level of staff that it takes to administer it?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, we currently have a loan portfolio of about just under $500 million. Our staffing has not substantially changed in numbers. I think the last significant increase in staff for the organization was in the early 90s. So we've been fairly stable. We have reallocated some staff through creating more efficient loan servicing systems. We now do outreach and early awareness out of our Anchorage office as well to try to reach students earlier. So we have reduced the number of staff who are actually active on loan servicing and redeployed those resources. So if we were to eliminate that activity from the commission, you could certainly affect some reduction in staffing.
Thank you. Could you give us a comparison in the dollar amount to, say, right now, $5 million in loans? What was it at a point in the past?
Well, when the corporation was making both federally guaranteed as well as the state loans, we were issuing in excess of $80 million a year in loans. Program was ended by the current administration in Washington in 2008. And since then, we've seen a rapid decline in our loan volume. We attribute that to a couple of different things. One is that the Congress, seeking to protect the consumer against lenders who were not federal education loan lenders, created sort of barriers between even they failed to make a distinction about state-based programs, which we sought at the time, but they thought that this was a good idea. So we can no longer partner with schools. The school can't recommend the state loan. In fact, they can't even list us as sort of a preferred lender. So that's been a factor. And the other has been just that we promoted very effectively the federally guaranteed loan as the best loan. And at the same time, in order to issue bonds in the market, we had to change the underwriting criteria so that students now need to have either a creditworthy, they need to either be creditworthy themselves or have a creditworthy cosigner. So when with our applicants, we have a decline rate of about 40% right now. So we're only funding about 60% of those that apply for loans. So substantial change.
Yes. Thank you, Ms. Behrens. Further comments, questions? Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Behrens, as far as the schools that you can issue loans to students, other than some that may not be in good academic standard, is there any preclusion of certain that are not state, let's call them private schools, religious schools that the state is supporting the student in?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, the requirement for the institutions is that they be accredited.
Okay.
So if they're regionally or nationally accredited, then they can participate.
Right. Thank
or,
you.
Or if they're in Alaska and they're approved by the commission to operate and to participate in the loan program, then they can. So if a religious school is accredited and issues credentials, then they can participate.
Thank you. Further questions? Senator Grinder.
Just briefly, for the average 18-year-old, am I right in assuming they're not deemed creditworthy, they would have to have a cosigner?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, yes, you can find exceptions to that, but they're few and far between.
Thank you.
Obviously, you know my children. Thank you for the questions. Thank you very much, both Senator Fairclough and Ms. Behrens. Anybody else you asked to testify? Thank you, Senator Fairclough. We'll open the public hearing then. Tim, do we have anybody signed up? Nobody signed up? Okay, we'll close the public hearing. And any further discussion among the committee? Questions, comments? And let's go to the will of the committee then. Senator Dunleavy.
I move SB 195 version U from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Thank you. Is there any disagreement? We'll take brief at ease. Thank you. The Education Committee, come back to order, please. We have before us Senate Bill 100, and I believe this is version G before us. Senator Dunleavy, are you presenting or your staff?
Both.
Thank you.
Through the chair, if I could have Sheila come up and introduce herself, and we can go over one more time the changes to this version.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Sheila Peterson. My name is Sheila Peterson, staff to Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, Mrs. Peterson.
Just as a recap of the changes, we made sure that the individual learning plan would be created with the assistance of a certified teacher as well as the approval of that certified teacher with a parent and child. We added that the progress of the student would be monitored by the certificated teacher that was assigned to that child, that the vendors that were being used for the education would be non-sectarian. They would be public, they could be private, or they could be religious organizations. That the textbook selection would have to follow the same criteria that normal public school students, teachers, administrators used. We indicated that once a student left the correspondence program, and if they had any unexpended allotment money, that those dollars would go back to the district programs. And we also made sure that a family member who was helping with the instruction of the child would not be reimbursed by the allotment funds. And those are the changes that are in version G.
Thank you very much. And just to remind us, the family members are who, Ms. Peterson?
It's quite extensive. It defines a family member as a student's spouse, guardian, parent, step-parent, sibling, step-sibling, grandparent, step-grandparent, child, uncle, or aunt. So it's a very confined group.
It is indeed, yes. Thank you. Questions? Seeing none, let me just to touch on a subject. Do you see any constitutional issues in this? I guess maybe the one thing you can use, vendors can be religious institutions, but what we're only talking about, or maybe you could explain that a little bit so we fully understand it.
You have in your modern homeschool programs throughout the state, many of those programs employ vendors for the purpose of supporting a public ILP. Vendors are approved by the school districts. Vendors can consist of folks that are private individuals that have a business license, that tutor private individuals, that own businesses, for example, in different martial arts. There are businesses that employ folks to do reading tutorials or math tutorials. There are vendors that, such as APU, such as Brigham Young, that's employed. A whole host of different types of vendors, both locally, statewide, and throughout the country, are employed. The important point is that they're being employed, their coursework is being purchased for the support of a public ILP, for public purpose and a public outcome. In terms of constitutionality, that's a difficult one to define because you almost have to have a court action to determine the constitutionality of some of the things that we're doing. If, just for example, the bill we just passed out of committee calls for student representation on the post-secondary board from private institutions. And we have many private institutions at the secondary level that we actually give money in a more direct fashion than we do at the K-12 level. So it's my understanding that if we're purchasing a course or a service in its totality to support a public ILP, that should not be a problem. But to be honest with you, Mr. Chairman, people can sue for any reason at any time. An effort to test the law or test the constitutionality of something.
Thank you, Senator Levy. Further questions of Senator Sheila? Yes, Senator Gardner.
Thank you. In answer to your question, Mr. Chair, of course, this bill sponsor is correct. You never know until somebody takes it to court for sure, but we do have a constitutional opinion that this does not violate the Constitution.
Thank you. For the comments, Senator Sedman.
And we could have Senator Gardner for the record define we.
My office. Thank you.
Aye.
Thank you. Further comments or questions? Thank you very much, Sheila.
You're welcome.
Anybody else that you had asked to prepare testimony?
No, we have Mr. Wicker here in the audience who would speak to the one-on-one technology aspect. He already testified online at the last meeting.
Thank you. Department of Education, any comments we care to make at this time?
Susan McCauley, Director of Teaching and Learning Support for the Department of Education Early Development. We've had a continued conversation with Senator Dunleavy, the sponsor, regarding Senate Bill 100. Quite a few of the components in the bill mirror elements that are currently in regulation regarding correspondence study school programs. The additions actually in the CS actually track pretty closely with quite a bit of the content in regulation, particularly those now on page 4, line 24, with regard to textbook services and other curriculum materials, having some approval processes at the district level, being aligned to state standards, and so on. So just, I guess my only comment then is that these changes, I think, reflect ongoing conversation and are largely in line with some of our current processes.
Thank you, Dr. McCauley. Question, Senator Gardner.
Thank you. Dr. McCauley, on page 4, line 10, at section B, notwithstanding another provision of law, the department may not impose additional requirements other than the requirements specified under A of this section and under AS 1403-320 on a student who's proficient or advanced on statewide assessments. This element of the bill has always puzzled me because I don't know any other additional requirements that might be required or imposed. Can you enlighten me on that matter?
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Gardner, currently in regulation there are some restrictions regarding the use of allotment funds. Things like membership to a gym, family travel, those two come to mind right away. And I believe in previous conversation there were questions, for example, regarding whether or not the language you just referenced would restrict the department from monitoring whether a student used an allotment to pay for services provided by a family member. That language has now been added to the bill and clearly is and extensively is now restricted. But there are currently in regulation, those two examples are two examples that we would view as our not being, that those would fall under imposing additional requirements, and that that language specifically in regulation would be at odds with this new language when a student is proficient, and that we would not be monitoring in the same manner potentially as we are now if a student is proficient.
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Senator Gardner.
So do I understand then that a student enrolled in a program under this bill might be able to use the allotment funds for travel or for a gym membership?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, it is my understanding that those would be permitted because they are not exclusively restricted, and they would fall under a broad category of imposing additional requirements when a student is proficient, and we would not be doing that.
Mr. Gardner?
The chair, thank you. And yet the services and materials would have to be part of the individual learning plan and would have to be from a vendor who's approved by the school district and aligned to state standards, et cetera.
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, that's correct. So there are in this CS, I'm sorry, is it CS? Yes, there are now those approval processes. There's also, I'm trying to find, perhaps Senator Dunleavy knows specifically, there is language in the bill that talks about that services must be for an instructional purpose. And those services would need to, the use of student allotment funds would need to be connected to the student's ILP and for an instructional purpose. So I think even with the may not impose additional requirements language, there are still some other safeguards, so to speak, in the bill language regarding that the purpose of those allotment funds are to support instruction and do have some approval processes in place.
Thank you.
Thank you. Could you point that out, Senator R. Sheila? The specific issue about must be used for instructional purposes, just so we...
Senator,
yes.
Stevens, I believe I just spotted it on page 4, the original, page 4, line 15.
Through the chair.
Senator Dunleavy.
In obviously, in my opinion, this bill probably has more safeguards than many of our current school K-12 schools. You have to build an ILP with the certified teacher. The certified teacher is not going to approve any expenditure that does not support the ILP that was agreed upon by the teacher and the parent. And so this is really a bill that focuses on the outcomes. If you're proficient, why would you want the department spending resources monitoring you when you have a school district, a school, and a teacher doing that? That's the purpose.
Thank you, Senator. Specifically, I don't think that answers my question. Where does it say it must be used for instructional purposes?
Sure. Page 4.
Page 4.
Under section 1403320.
Right.
Line 17. And then there's another section in here. Page 4, line 30.
On 22 and 23 on page 4.
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Senator Garner.
I believe that page 4, line 14 on downward, it really is the nub of what we're looking at here.
I'm not trying to be argumentative. That talks about instructional expenses. We've heard somebody say must be for instructional purposes only. I don't really see those words in here. Am I missing something, Sheila?
Mr. Chairman, it does say that for the allotment, they provide an annual student allotment to the parent or guardian.
And what line page are you on?
I'm on page 4, line 16.
Right.
For the student enrolled into the program for the purpose of meeting instructional expenses for the student enrolled into the program as provided. And it also on page 4, line 30, says that it must support a public purpose, and the public purpose being the education of that child.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you, Sheila. Mm-hmm. Further questions? So thank you all very much. We've heard from the department. Any further comments from the department? Thank you, Dr. McCauley. Anyone else from Associate School Boards or Superintendents here to speak? If not, thank you. Thank you, Bob. I have you down there. Let's open public testimony then. We have Pete Lewis from Fairbanks School District, Superintendent there. Superintendent Lewis, can you hear me?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Identify yourself for the record, if you would, please.
Thank you. Pete Lewis, Superintendent of the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District. I'm here this morning to speak in support of Senate Bill 100, Version G. I just wanted to touch base quickly on the personalized learning grants, and that we appreciate the one-to-one portion of the bill and the 80-20 match with the 10% in-kind contribution. Being one that would be very favorable to school districts, and as we move towards online assessment, you know, we're already there with regard to work keys, but as we come forward with additional assessments that are online, it will be important that we have these devices in students' hands as to prepare them well for what they're going to face each and every day as they move forward into the future. I also want to speak in support of the innovative learning grants and specifically the replicating language. As resources become tighter and tighter, it is important that we get good ideas and that we have the ability to bring those ideas to scale across the state. With this replicating language, I think that those innovative ideas can be moved forward and shared across this across the state that would allow us to use those ideas in a way that could save resources and ultimately improve student achievement. And last but not least, I just wanted to speak to the correspondence study program funding. And as we look at moving to moving that to a 1.0 funding ratio, would like the committee to consider the possibility of a phase-in approach to that as resources are tight and as you're looking to try to manage that. Moving to the 1.0 ratio is a good move. But if resources are not there, you might look at a phase-in approach, and we have a long history of that in this state in a variety of different areas. But I do want to speak on behalf of the bill, and happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Superintendent Lewis. Any questions of Mr. Lewis? Thank you, sir, very much for your comments. We have no further public testimony. We'll close the public testimony and come back to the committee and discussion or comments at this time. Any amendments? Will of the committee, then.
I move SB 100, version G, from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Thank you. Any objection? Take the brief at ease. Here, is there any further business to come before the committee? If not, we're adjourned.